I mean, I always say that the big difference between religion and superstition is politics.
Folklorist, a skeptic, and a cultural anthropologist who specializes in the supernatural, the paranormal, and cryptozoology. And today, we discuss why it is that people believe in weird stuff, how in certain places throughout history, the ideas of vampirism and witchcraft and fairies were commonplace beliefs. Not only that, why nowadays do we even have a distinction between the superstitious and religion, when once upon a time, these ideas were much more blended? We also discuss skepticism as a whole and the associated charlatans and conspiracies, ranging from sunning your anus to healers who claim to be able to cure cancer sufferers. So, with that in mind, please welcome the supernatural, Deborah Hyde.
Mind-bending chemicals.
I don't care, he wants to kill me.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
When I start speaking to podcast guests, because it's interesting reading maybe articles online or Wikipedia pages about them just to see, I suppose, what people think about them. And you probably have one of the funniest ones because your Wikipedia says you're known as a vampire expert. And across all the people in Wikipedia, I don't think there would be that many whose first line says vampire expert. So how did you manage that?
Well, I think it came from a natural enthusiasm, really. Mm-hmm. I've always been interested in the dark side of human belief. And it's always struck me as a bit strange, actually, that it's respectable to study religion, but people think you're being frivolous if you study ghosts or folklore. Mm. And certainly as I was growing up, things hadn't quite changed in that respect yet. Now there are all sorts of people having very respectable academic careers, studying the psychology of why people believe in strange things. Professor Chris French, Professor Richard Wiseman, Professor Caroline Watt. But mm-hmm. It was very much a fringe thing as I was growing up, and I just loved it. I was just always attracted to it. So I guess when you really have a passion for something and then you spend a lot of time reading about it, that's how you become a vampire expert.
Mm. You know, it's funny as well because, you know, for yourself and I suppose a few of the other academics that you were kind of mentioning there, it's strange because you're in a strange place. You're on the border because, you know, yourself being sort of a skeptic, you would, you know, think off the top of your head that you'd sort of be very, very much against the idea of vampires and the paranormal and things like that. But you sort of have this love and admiration for it at the same time as being a skeptic. So how do you sort of mix those two together?
Oh, yeah, I could definitely sell more tickets if I believed in them. I mean, without a doubt,
can imagine.
If you believe in ghosts and vampires and God knows what else, then you can, you know, you can make a lot of money. I think, and from what I understand speaking to the other people who share my passions, mm-hmm. that really what motivates us is the fact that, first of all, the stories are interesting. I mean, they're mm-hmm. kind of, we don't watch horror fiction by mistake. We watch movies and we read the mm-hmm. books and all this kind of thing because it's fascinating. There's a natural gravitation for human beings towards this kind of material. But if you read a lot of it, I mean, I don't just mean all the fiction, but I mean the folklore and the historical accounts, mm-hmm. You have to realize that it represents a fairly consistent thread through human nature. Mm. So even if the creatures themselves don't exist, it's still relevant because it says something about us. It says something about the way that we systematically process the world. And so I gave up believing in supernatural beings many, many years ago, but the fascination didn't stop because there was the subject and there was the fact that it was still a very key insight onto the way that human beings perceive the world.
That's an interesting point too that you just mentioned, that you did believe once upon a time. Is that when you were a child, or did it extend longer into sort of being a teenager or adulthood?
It did extend a little bit into, I guess being a teenager, that was about And a little bit into adulthood too, yes. I mean, I wondered about ghosts as recently as my 20s, so which weren't very recent, actually. So it was when I grew up, my mother's side of the family was... it was a bunch of mad old aunties, and it was just fantastic because we would go up there and they all smoked, so it would be like some special effects department had smoked the room up to make the place extra atmospheric for us. And it was in the north of England where the sun never shines, so right. You can imagine a sort of a grey day and these horrific spine-chilling tales that they would tell us, and which were all theoretically true. I mean, you know, my mother wouldn't let me watch horror films in case it warped my fragile mind, but she would let me listen to this stuff that was allegedly true. So I picked this stuff up just, it was stimulating, and it was fascinating, and it was just a wonderful fantasy place. And of course I believed in it because of these older people around me saying that there were ghosts and spirits and bad guides and all this kind of stuff. And now I recognize it as a kind of a pop mash of what they would have been picking up when they were growing up, the remnants basically of 19th century spiritualism and that sort of thing. And so when you get a frisson like that, it doesn't disappear easily. My parents had a book by a guy called Richard Cavendish called The Black Art. So I suspect it was my father's, not my mother's.
Okay.
And I wasn't supposed to read that or the one on Jack the Ripper. So as a result, it was kept on a very high shelf, which meant that I had to wait till they went out to get the chair and then get the books off the high shelf. And so I read both of these books fairly early. And the thing about The Black Arts is it was a 60s lurid covered paperback, and it looked completely, it just looked sensational. But in actual fact, there was an awful lot of, it explained the religion of occultism, how the beliefs were fairly systematic. They were no dafter than, you know, the various mainstream religions we've got. So all of a sudden I realized that it was, first of all, this stuff wasn't true, and it was mystical, but also that there was some systematic belief behind it. And that fascinated me, because by then my favorite lesson at school was comparative religion, and I was thinking, this is just another religion.
I guess with the fact of religion, that we do have some sort of thing in our heads that we separate sort of... what's the right way to put it? I guess like silliness, things that we know are fantasy, yet we have to treat, you know, certain religions and beliefs with a certain amount of respect when they don't necessarily deserve it any more than those other tales, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I always say that the big difference between religion and superstition is politics, because with religion you have various, you have stratified hierarchies usually. You give out certificates to prove that somebody is able to carry the word of God from an authority to the normal people. And it involves power, it involves money. And so, but really the sort of misapprehension of what the world around us is pretty much the same. And in fact, most people throughout history, even when you see what we would regard as dividing the world into superstitious elements and religious elements is actually very hard when you look at the history. I mean, we think we can do it very straightforwardly. Reading your horoscope is silly, but taking communion is respectable. Whereas historically, people didn't experience their beliefs as being two or three strands, some of them more or less respectable than the others. What they would do generally is religions were very syncretic. That is, you integrate all of the various elements and you come up with very different forms of religion in different places. The kind of evangelistic revival type Christianity that might be practiced in some parts of the United States is very different from, for example, Catholic Christianity as practiced in the Vatican today. But they're both from the same origin, and they have both taken different strands. I mean, I'm thinking specifically of witchcraft as well, because an awful lot of people wouldn't have thought themselves evil or wrong for taking various witchcraft type elements into their religious lives in the 16th or 17th centuries mm-hmm. in the UK and in Europe. People would go to church and they would pray to God, and they would also, you know, take measures against fairies or spirits or bad influences, or they would go to local wise men and women to try and help them with illnesses. So when people are living it, they don't separate out in their minds usually the differences between the authorized and the unauthorized mm-hmm. versions of their supernatural schema. But when we look at it from a top-down perspective, we say, well, oh yes, some of this is daft and some of this is respectable because a man in a black frock says it.
That's the thing. And I, like exactly what you just said, you know, we can draw a line so easily when we look at it now. But, you know, I recently read Stephen Fry's Mythos, which was a really good book. And
oh, yeah.
Just from that, I didn't realize, I always knew about it from school and stuff, but I really didn't realize how much influence old religions had on the religions that we have today, if that sort of makes sense. How just yeah. kind of recycled, stolen stories to a certain degree. And for us, we look back and think about Zeus and things like that and think it's ridiculous. We know it's, so we're not necessarily ridiculous, but we know it's fantasy. But there's obviously a point in history where these two religions, the newer ones and the older ones, were sort of blending in together. So I guess, why does one win out and one, I guess, loses and falls into that place of we consider superstition and not a real religion?
That is such a big question. That's an
it
absolute,
is, isn't it?
Yeah, and it varies from each occasion as well, because religions generally... religions are a manifestation of the underlying society. It mm-hmm. might be that, it might not be so much that, the other way to look at this is not so much that you integrate old religious ideas, but that there are certain sort of archetypal ideas that appeal to us.
Yeah.
The kind of Jungian idea. And that they just manifest themselves in different ways in different societies. And it depends on your society and your economy as to whether or not you're going to find certain ideas useful. For example, goddess worship has kind of been out of fashion for a few thousand years. Mm. But it was a very, very big thing prior to that. So you can look at societies to wonder why religion has become, or more the kind of religion we're used to, has become more patriarchal. I think religion is the sign of the underlying empire and economy that generates it.
It might just be fitting in, I suppose, to the Jungian idea and be fitting into what we need, I guess, a need in a society or a need on a personal perspective. But the thing is, too, I guess... the current technologies that we have at the time does change it too. You know, there's this sort of thought that certain amounts of religion is sort of an ever proceeding, receding aspect of our society, because I suppose we understand certain things about science. Once upon a time, we thought the sun revolved around the earth, and then, you know, Copernicus threw that all into pieces, and then we think about it differently. I guess that's probably happened many, many times in many, many different facets, but with these paranormal things that we do not believe today, was there a time in history where we did believe them as much as we would a religion? For example, a few hundred years ago, did we genuinely believe that vampires were a thing and ghosts were an important part of our lives? Or is it always kind of been a part of mysticism and less religion?
Well, you know, like I said, people don't really experience their religion and their superstition. Those are two terms that we would use as being separate. So,
right.
Of course. I mean, they could integrate their peculiar, what we would regard as peculiar beliefs, into their mainstream religious beliefs. People absolutely did believe in vampires. Mm. It's their creatures, revenants of all sorts, that is to say, people who come back from the dead, are present in every culture as far as we can tell. But the specific configuration where you have somebody come back from the dead, there's been a series of epidemic deaths, and you examine their corpse and their corpse hasn't decomposed as you would expect. That comes from Eastern Europe, and the stories all made their way westwards in kind of the 1730s or so. And that wasn't because the stories were suddenly invented then. In fact, they'd been part of religious practice for hundreds of years prior to that in their own location. It was just that the political map of Europe changed a great deal. The Ottoman Empire, the Southeast, had occupied a great deal of Europe up to the Balkans and further on occasion. Mm-hmm. And the Habsburg Empire was pushing against it. So it depended where the borders were, who'd won the battles that year, as to which peasant population fell under which government. And the vampire panic of 1730s was because the Habsburgs had pushed back and they'd got a great deal of land and they were administering over people who had been using these traditional rites, these traditional kinds of means of getting rid of vampires. And being Roman Catholic, they were appalled at the desecration. They didn't think that you should go around doing horrible things to corpses. But it was part of the religious background in the East. For a start, they had different religions. They had some Protestantism, like Lutheranism. Mm-hmm. They had Islam. They had Orthodox Christianity. And they also had the historical influence of sort of Slav pagan beliefs, where it seems to have been with that basically if the earth received you when you died, that was a blessing. The earth was a mother. So if she spat you back out again, there was something wrong with you. You were being rejected. Mm-hmm. So this was a whole integrated universe in the lands that the practices were developed in. They would see somebody, if there was an epidemic death, and also this comes down to human beings trying to control hideous circumstances too. Mm. If there was an epidemic, and it wouldn't necessarily all have to be from the same cause, just a lot of people dying at the same time, they would be very worried about that. And they felt that if they could find the architect of all of this by looking at all of the corpses and seeing who was still fresh in their grave, then if they got rid of that corpse, they could stop the epidemic. And wow. it makes perfect sense if you don't have the kind of knowledge that we do.
Yeah.
And it's also very therapeutic because they feel that they understood what was going on and they could take control of the situation.
I guess it's a control thing, isn't it? They're actually sort Absolutely. Of treating the problem. So that's, I mean, I'm very naive in terms of this. I know sort of nothing about this, but there was genuinely historically people were making efforts to sort of stamp out the vampires in their area then?
Oh, absolutely. There were two big cases that made their way westwards. And the people in the West also, these were pamphlets that were best-selling pamphlets because people in the West just sort of sucked up these stories. They were lurid and...
Loved it.
Yeah, the same reason we like vampire films. They enjoyed vampire stories in the 1730s in Paris and Leipzig. There are two main cases. One was a guy called Arnold Paul, and the other one was a guy called Peter Plajogovic. And when I went to Serbia, I got told off. They taught me how to pronounce his name properly, which I'm not going to insult anyone by trying to do now.
Not going to butcher.
So these archetypal stories came out, but there's no doubt that they represent a great deal of folk practice. And the peculiar thing is, I don't know if you've seen on my website, but I went to Rhode Island in North America.
Yes, I did see that.
And there was a similar kind of thing going on there in the 1800s. And nobody really knows quite how the superstition or the practice made its way to there. But a similar kind of thing happened. It was a reaction to tuberculosis, a disease they called consumption. And a woman called Mercy Brown died of it. Various members of her family had died of it. And they ended up exhuming her and doing appalling things to her corpse in an attempt to stop her brother dying of the same disease. So that was as recently as the 1890s North America.
Yeah, it's so recent. And is there like... This might sound a bit silly, but do we know anything about where this idea sort of stemmed from? I mean, we know that, as you mentioned, come from certain countries, from the East over to Europe, that kind of thing. But the idea of an actual vampire, why did they think it was a vampire and not some other cause? Why was that the thing that stuck out?
Well, if it had been in rural Ireland at the time, they would probably have attributed it to the fairies.
Right.
So you get people responding with their own folklore to different stimuli. Actually, at a very similar time that Mercy Brown's corpse was being dug up, there was a woman called Bridget Cleary in County Clonmel in Ireland who was burned alive for being a fairy changeling. And
wow.
Yeah, so again, she's a very peculiar case as well, because there's plenty of evidence in the 19th century that children were hurt for being changelings, but she's the only adult that we know of that late. So you're quite right, the person's own folkloric context will depend on how they perceive what's going on. In general, if you're going to be assaulted by something supernatural, then the symptoms will tend to be that you start to fade for no apparent reason. People didn't have a biological theory of disease. And if somebody just started to fade away, it was as though their life was being taken from them gradually. Mm-hmm. And people might attribute that to a supernatural being.
I'm not sure if you're aware of any of the actual sort of statistics of it. This is just something that I listened to on a podcast the other day, just about the belief of God and the belief of the devil and stuff and across America and a few other sort of Western places. And many more people in a number of these places believe in sort of demons and bad spirits more than they actually believe in God, which sort of brings up the question, you know, people do sort of naturally think that there is some negative energy that is going around doing something. So it's not that much of a stretch to go to vampires or witches or something like that in the right situation.
No, not at all. Was that specifically in the United States?
That was a US one. I don't want to say anything too specific because I'll get it completely wrong. It was just a podcast I listened to with Sean Carroll where they were discussing the idea of hell. And it was in the US this study was.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me. And I bet if you did the same poll in Europe that the results would be different. And
you
the
think
reason,
so?
Yeah, I think so. Because one of the things that really trips people's focus on bad influences on demonic entities is an inconsistency of luck, being prone to the vagaries of fate. You can completely sympathize with our ancestors and understand them. They lived before antibiotics. They lived, you know, when really whether or not you were starved to death depended on the results of the latest harvest.
Yeah, where the same woman's having a miscarriage, where this, that, and the other's happening. Same people are getting disease, same family have the same disease, things like that.
Yeah. And so really with the kind of social support, governmental social support that you have in Europe with being a lot higher, I think the belief in nasty demons tends to be lower because people don't really need to concentrate on it. In the United States, of all of the industrialized and rich countries, it's a place where you can fall hard and quickly.
Very far.
And if you're poor, you know, you're in a bad way.
I guess the other thing too is, you know, you were mentioning that the religion and these things that we can consider as superstitious now sort of blended into one another once upon a time. So I guess that brings up the question now in your, I suppose, line of work, what is the point of being a skeptic for these sort of things? Why not sort of allow people to have their sort of beliefs in psychics, beliefs in the paranormal, if it is just something that in the past has blended in with religion? Why is it a big deal to sort of question it?
First of all, it's something I would do for fun anyway. This is just a subject that I have a passion about.
Just a hobby.
Yeah, yeah. So, and all the people I know who professionally I deal with and who give talks and write blogs and write in the newspaper and stuff is just, you know, this is a passion we have. And
if somebody
says something peculiar, you know, it just sets you off. You go, oh, I wonder what's behind that. But secondly, after that, if you want to try and have some kind of some social meaning to your work, I do think that it's important to provide people with the intellectual tools to escape it if they want to. There is no doubt in my mind that there is some awful harm done by some types of belief. Now, there's the kind of stuff where you can go, psychic shows can be entertaining, but they can also be attended by people who are really can't find closure after somebody's died. And there's some predator taking 20 quid off them to tell them that they've got a message through. I did a radio interview once with a woman who was a healer, and she was dealing with people who had end-stage cancer or even earlier stage cancer, which could be actually addressed if it was looked at properly. So under circumstances like that, I have no compunction whatsoever. I think I'm doing a social service. She operated in Ireland rather than in England because it was illegal to claim to be able to treat people for cancer in England. So there is real harm done, and I'm a great supporter of the National Secular Society and Humanists UK in the UK because they campaign for legal disentwining of religious interests and law. So you don't have to, I mean, I don't mind whether somebody goes to church on a Sunday or not. It really couldn't bother me at all. But I do mind if they are lobbying to get anti-choice legislation put in that will affect women I know. So that's it, so there's the greater societal kind of, you know, you have the freedom to be religious, but we live in a secular society. And I think that's a great way to have it. And a bit of education about the history and the way that religion has worked is a very, very important thing for people to realize that this is still an ongoing subject. And also, I don't think we can get complacent about the fact we live in pretty much the most luxurious time and place in history.
Yes.
If you live in certain places in Africa at the moment, for example, and you have no money or you have no parents and you're about 9 years old, you can get accused of witchcraft and be beaten to death. So these, and there are evangelical churches that are making an awful lot of money promoting this kind of belief. And there are absolutely heroic people out there. One of them, to my mind, is Leo Igwe, who I keep in contact with. He does incredible work against witchcraft accusation in Nigeria. And so this stuff is current. It's not just frivolous.
I remember for a while when I was at university, I was kind of the opinion, like, what's the big deal? And then I read Carl Sagan's Demon Haunted World book.
Oh, yeah. That starts a lot of people off. Yeah.
I think it's the gateway drug to being a skeptic. But yeah, it was amazing just because he was really sort of laying out there the reasons in which this is harmful, not only on a personal perspective, also financial and economically, you know, things like this that I just never really thought of, and that changed my mind. But I suppose it must really shock you to see, I feel as if there is a trend towards almost more woo happening nowadays with the internet than maybe there was within the last sort of decade or so, in terms of, like, astrology seems to be extremely popular with young women, water bottles infused with crystals, you know, that kind of thing. That must be sort of worrying for you.
Have you seen the people sunning their anuses?
I have. I haven't tried it myself, so I don't want to knock it yet. But
don't do that. No, it's funny. It's just something that I've only become aware of in the last week. Yeah. I think every time, you know, I hear about sort of, I don't know, vagina eggs or something, you think, oh, this can't get any sillier. And then I think that's slightly down to something different, which is, first of all, there is the desire for control, and younger people have less control than older people always have had. So perhaps that's, you can see why that's a fashionable thing amongst young people. But also in our society, I suppose we don't all go to church. We're not all conformists. We all want to be different. We all want to be saying the same in different ways, don't we? So yes. I think that being sort of asserting yourself as some kind of, expert in something. I sort of see the crystals and the anti-vax stuff and all that kind of thing as part of an assertive middle-class sensibility that we have, that we're entitled to our own opinions.
Feels like that.
Yeah. And of course, we are entitled to our own opinions, but we're not entitled to our own facts.
That's the thing, too. I think it makes it a little bit harder, a bit more of a harder pill to swallow, should we say, when you were mentioning before about the very real sort of issues with witchcraft going on in Africa and things like that. So, you know, when I see stuff in terms of, like what we're mentioning before, the crystals and even the absolute popularity of Flat Earth at the moment. I'm not sure if you've seen the Flat Earth documentary on Netflix, have you?
No, I haven't, but I went to a talk by Michael Marshall recently, from everybody would recognize him from the internet, about the Flat Earth thing, and it was hilarious.
Yeah, it's like it is kind of, you hit the nail on the head with it. The guy that's in the documentary, I was speaking to a friend about it, and we both are convinced that he's sort of he was thinking about it at first, and then he started making a bit of money from it, and now he's just kind of like, he's just stuck with it. I genuinely don't think he personally believes it, but he's making money from it now, and why wouldn't you? And it is like that standing out sort of thing. Yeah. Which I guess,
well,
yeah,
also,
like I said,
when
we all
have,
want to be individual.
A couple of things. First of all, when you have a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail. So you're just going to apply your expertise to whatever situation you see. And second of all, it's very difficult for people to just give up their social status, their method of making money. One of the reasons I think that witch trials developed, only one reason, though it's a very complex thing, but that the Dominicans had been created as a group in the 12th century or so to deal with heresy in the Catholic Church. And, you know, after a while, they had no mission. They had to go around finding people and finding missions and finding things. And so it's kind of, there's lots of examples where people's expertise almost hems them in, if you like.
Mm. They have to stick with it, I guess.
Yeah.
And that is the thing with conspiracy theorists in general. It is really like that. Like everything suddenly has to turn into a conspiracy.
Yeah. Yeah, and it also attributes real hyper-competence to all of these authorities. And if we know anything about an awful lot of authorities, is that they're only half-competent, really.
That's right.
It all comes out eventually.
It all comes out in the wash. On the sort of opposite to that, I do feel that there is some people who are potentially like too skeptical is the wrong word, but they almost don't believe anything that could be slightly outrageous. And you must have thought about this throughout your sort of career, that there does sort of have to be a line where you do need a certain amount of understanding that the universe can do extremely weird things. So where's the balance between those two?
I don't know. I think my equivalent of that, I suppose, is I lack patience with people who think that people are dumb for being religious or superstitious, for that matter. And I can absolutely assure you it's got nothing to do with intellect. You know, some of the most bright people you will ever meet will be devoutly religious, and some of the daftest will not have any religion or superstition at all. It's a human, you know, there's a human constant in the absence of the old, propaganda from the other side. So I think the thing that gets me is when people just think that when we get better, when we get cleverer, that we'll stop being religious. And I really just don't think it's that easy.
There's a bit of arrogance there, I think. There is the big question that I do need to ask, which I suppose it always leads up to, is like, why do people believe? What is the point of it? Because actually, there's someone I was talking about a few weeks ago on a podcast that I was on. There's an astronomer in Australia, a very, very famous astronomer. I think he's like the most successful amateur astronomer in the world, maybe. He's identified so many of these things, yet he is a very, very, very religious man, Christian man. And that is like the perfect example of someone being very scientifically minded, very intelligent, yet still has that religion. So what is the reason for that?
Well, it depends on how much you pit science and religion against each other. And there are various, for example, recent evangelical churches are not very good at doing this because they try and sort of meet science head on. And when there's a direct argument between science and religion, science is going to win every single time. So you have to retreat. You have to philosophically come at it from a different angle if you want mm-hmm. to survive. You have to be more sophisticated. The Catholic Church is very good at this, for example. And also the Catholic Church has a very decent array of very well-qualified scientists, mm-hmm. astronomers and so forth. And it depends where you put the line between God and science, I suppose. If you've got a mechanistic universe from which God has stepped backwards, then everything that you can understand in terms of science will mm-hmm. be God's work, evidence of the existence of God. And a lot of people just want to approach something mystical, something big, something they don't understand through whatever vehicle they've grown up with. I think that of the surveys that have been done time and time again, by far the vast majority of scientists are not religious. They tend to, it gets lost along the way. And it's easy to concentrate on the odd exception here and there because it, you know, it throws a little difference into the mix. It depends where you put that line.
I think it's funny as well because now we're seeing sort of a redefinition of the word like spirituality as well, right? Because spirituality once upon a time was such a religious thing and it obviously still is, but you know, I know so many scientists that who I guess you would expect to be the most down the line, not believing sort of anything outside any sort of realm of possibility, who are, you know, extremely spiritual. Maybe they think of things in a completely different light. They meditate, they do this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's a good thing to a certain degree, right? Because we are sort of reclaiming a bit more of that, I guess, beauty of the world around us, while at the same time still being rational about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, you don't want the whole, you don't want science and skepticism to be populated by what looks to the outside world by a legion of automata. Mm. We seek and desire the transcendent as much as anybody does. It's just that we find it in different ways. And it doesn't have to last forever in terms of an afterlife or to have to come from some authority for it to be valid. I mean, we still appreciate, you know, we appreciate the world we live in. We appreciate the people we love. There are absolutely ways of having a transcendent life without believing in a deity.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it. It's a good way to put it. We're getting sort of close-ish to the end of the podcast. There is one more thing that I did want to ask you about, which is, I guess, the most common, in my mind anyway, the most common extension from religion into sort of folklore and superstition, which is ghosts. Because I know tons of people, I have friends that I've had late night discussions with who are not even remotely, slightly at all religious, wouldn't dare read their star sign, yet have complete faith and belief that there are ghosts. Do you believe, have you seen that that is sort of a separate category altogether in terms of believing?
No, I think it's integral with everything else. It kind of goes back to your previous question, a bit that I missed out, which is, what is the function of believing? Why do we end up believing? And you can look at it from two angles. You can say that there is a greater adaptive function to people who have certain supernatural beliefs and who pull together in a certain way. And there's a lot of evidence for that. And there's also a lot of evidence for the other side. I think the real answer is a combination of both, that religion and superstition come from natural side effects of our perception. So we do not have the bandwidth to rescan the world 10 times a second or 20 times a second and take everything in. We just can't do it. So there are some really, really good efficiencies that are built into our cognitive apparatus that sometimes go wrong. And as long as the price that you pay for them sometimes going wrong isn't death, it doesn't really matter. It's adaptive. Mm. I mean, if we accidentally see faces everywhere, well, it doesn't really matter if you're a bit jumpy, but you only get to ignore a tiger once. So true. That's an example. It's just one tiny example of how our whole cognitive apparatus, I mean, there's sort of top-down thinking instead of assimilating everything anew and interpreting it anew. There are so many ways that we can get things wrong by accident. And I think that ghosts are an absolute textbook case of how you can do this. If none of your listeners have heard of something called sleep paralysis, then definitely look it up, because it has given rise to so many cases of people seeing ghosts, and seeing fairies for that matter. So wow. It's a sleep blip. It isn't dangerous, but it can be enormously emotionally impactful, because you end up sort of being paralyzed and ineffectively dreaming while you're awake. So I think that if people believe in ghosts, it's perfectly natural, because chances are they have had some kind of peculiar experience, which is understandable in terms of our present knowledge of cognitive psychology. And then they have a cultural background with which to explain it, to integrate their experience into their lives. So, believing in ghosts is perfectly respectable.
Yeah, people don't really necessarily realize how fallible the mind is. Not fallible, but how it takes shortcuts necessarily, kind of. It sees things where things aren't there, and it believes things and remembers things that never happened and makes memories that this, that, and the other. And that's it too. You know, the sleep paralysis thing, I actually had a... was speaking about this on was it the last podcast or the podcast before, because I actually get some pretty substantial sleep paralysis. I was talking about this because if I was of a slightly different mind, it would have completely changed the way I think about the world. There was an instance I had about a year ago now that was, honestly, it still haunts me, honestly. I was in bed, I just moved into my new apartment, and I was sort of facing the wall, laying on my side, and I woke up, and there was somebody sitting on my legs. It wasn't like I felt like I was dreaming, and I thought someone was on my legs. I could feel the pressure of them sitting on my legs, and it went on for ages, and I woke up eventually, fully woke up, and I couldn't get back to sleep. It really disturbed me, honestly. And I thought to myself, if I was of the opinion of UFO abductions or of any sort of religious intervention, that would have been me hook, line, and sinker, you know?
Well, you would have moved out of the apartment. Lots of people are too terrified to go back. I mean, exactly. You know, yeah, absolutely. It can be an incredibly profoundly emotional experience. And the key thing to do is just a tip for your listeners is that if you can practice feeling love and acceptance, if you can get a hold of the fear, because it's the fear that perpetuates it, if you can, while you're conscious, just practice sort of throwing sort of love and acceptance waves out and being comfortable and being calm and being happy, that will quite often break it.
Yeah, well, that's for some people, I can imagine they need it, because the fear, I can imagine if someone getting it on a more regular basis than me, they'd be scared to go to sleep.
Yeah, oh, people have been. Yeah, there are accounts, there are 20th century accounts in a book by Ernest Jones on the nightmare. He's got various accounts of people who in the end, they were doing all sorts of ridiculous things. They were sleeping, sitting up. They were desperate, God, because they knew the minute they closed their eyes, it would start.
Something horrendous would happen.
Yeah.
Okay, Deborah, we're about 45 minutes now. So thank you very much for having the time and speaking with me and enlightening us on some probably horrible tales, to be honest with you. Nothing that nice.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. I've really enjoyed myself.
Thank you. And if anybody is sort of interested in what you had to say or wants to learn more about you or some of the topics, what should they do? What should they look at?
Please do follow me on Twitter. I'm at @yourdomain. I love speaking to people on Twitter. And my website is deborahhyde.com.
Perfect, Deborah. Thank you very much again. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Connor.
If you enjoyed this episode of the podcast, please subscribe to us. Go to any of our social media accounts or website. Tell your friends, tell your grandparents. Do anything you can do in your power to help us out, because it will allow us to continue doing this podcast for everybody, which we greatly appreciate. Thank you for the support, and see you next time.